She didn't pick the other guy. She picks out Rodney Lincoln.
7-year-old Melissa Davis has just told police the man who killed her mother, Joanne Tate, and brutally attacked her and her little sister, Renee, is in fact Rodney Lincoln. Metro PD has just picked him up.
Did you think you were coming back?
I thought I would. I told the girls, nothing's wrong. I'll be back in a little while. And on the way, it read me my rights. That's when it really struck me. Whoa, I'm really in trouble now.
I'm Leah Rothman. This is The Real Killer, Episode 3, Joanne and Rodney.
Anyway, I think I showed you last time, didn't I? But I've gotten actually bigger now.
Oh my gosh. This is unbelievable.
There's probably $30,000, $40,000 worth of stuff here. Easy.
I'm in Lynn, Missouri, at Nat and Lori Clenny's house, Joanne Tate's brother and sister-in-law. To say they're collectors is a major understatement. They have thousands of model cars, matchbox cars, and Pez dispensers, crafting supplies, VHS tapes, and vintage toys. All super organized with a sense of pride and sentimentality for all they've amassed.
This is my room where I come up. When I'm feeling kind of down and out, I'll come up and I'll relax. And I'll just sit here and look at all my junk. And you see my drawings, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, they're incredible.
I like to draw sometimes, too. But look at this, though. This is all my big screen TVs. Goes from all the way there to there.
Oh, my God.
And this look at Lori's madness, though, Leah. This is her sewing stuff. This used to be her company.
Wow.
Call it madness.
What else is
it? I would call it ingenious.
Do you still have the pictures in the hallway over here?
Yeah, down there, yeah.
But their most prized collection is of their family photos and home movies.
I think you've seen this one before because this was in the video. But there's Joanne there, but it's might be hard to see that one. Let's see, there's Joanne and that. Let's see. Let's see if we can find some more.
Oh, yeah. That was your birthday?
Yeah. I think he's seen them before. There's Melissa right there.
There's Melissa. They're in the front yard.
There's Melissa.
And I'm filming.
There's our dogs. I bought one of that one.
That's Samson. That was Samson. He lived to be 9. But, yeah, there's Melissa. She was probably 15.
I had to keep the boys away from her.
Let's see. Renee was 13 and Melissa was 15.
So wild to see her as a teenager.
Oh yeah.
Is it out there, Leah? Watch Call of Medicine, or?
I'm okay right now.
Yeah, you want you to see it anyway, you get it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Renee, there's Renee.
We call her Renee Bug. I call her Nana. She's a little kid.
So Nat, tell me about your family. Take me through the kids.
Joanne was the oldest, and then my brother Dan came along, and then my sister Rachel, and then Abby was the next one, and then I was the baby. I was born in 1963.
What's the age difference between you and Joanne?
Joanne would have been probably about 17, 18 years older than me.
How would you describe your home life growing up?
Mom and Dad really didn't have a relationship when I was growing up. Dad didn't really want all the kids. He didn't want all the extra ones. Mom wanted them. He just liked peace and quiet. I hardly ever saw my dad growing up because he was sleeping all the time.
Was your mom affectionate?
No. No, she come from a hard time, the depression, where you just didn't really show feelings. So, I mean, I never got picked up and hugged or loved, but I knew she loved me.
And what are some of your earliest memories of Joanne?
The earliest memories, I don't remember much, but my sister, she had a strong love for her brothers and sisters. I was dating this girl, and she was saying some negative things about me, and my sister got wind of it. And I was just about 15, and my girlfriend's about 14. And my sister, all of a sudden, I'm walking back from my girlfriend's house. It was across the highway. And I see my sister coming the other way. And she was mad. I mean, her face was red. And she looked like she was going to rip somebody to pieces. And I met her. I said, "Where are you going, Joanne?" She says, "I'm going to go over there. She's not going to say anything about my brother like that. Anything." I said, "Joanne, please, let me handle this myself." And I calmed her down, and then we turned around, and we walked back home together. She was a good sister. I mean, she loved her family. She would do whatever she could for her family. She'd fight for her family. She'd probably lay down her life for her family. I believe she would.
Fiercely loyal, sometimes to the wrong people. Around 1963, Joanne marries her first husband, and they have a daughter together. But that relationship is an abusive one, and it lands Joanne in the hospital on more than one occasion. Eventually, they divorce, and Joanne moves with some family members to Chicago for a fresh start. Or at least, that's what she hoped would happen.
We were in Chicago, and we were driving down this road, and then a drunk driver hit us head-on, about 70 miles an hour. And
Joanne was driving,
and I came to. The car was smoking. It was off the side of the road.
You were in the back seat.
I was in the back seat.
You
my
were
sister-in-law
about
10. And sister, they went through the window. And I got out of the car. The car was just crushed. And I hear them just moaning there. You can't get that out of your head. And I said, "I got to get help. There's nobody. It's a dark highway. It's January. It's cold out." And I ran down this highway. I don't know for how long, but blood was just coming out of my head, and it was warm.
11-year-old Nat, bleeding from a head wound, finally stops a passerby and gets help. Everyone survives the collision, but Joanne's injuries are severe.
Joe Baby, we called her Joe Baby. So Joanne, but Joe Baby, broke three of her ribs. The steering wheel went into her chest. She broke her hip in a couple places, broke her leg, broke her arm, broke her chin. So she was in a hospital for a long time. But they didn't think she would ever walk again.
Joanne refuses to accept that and eventually proves them wrong. But life for the 29-year-old will be forever changed.
She never could work anymore. And so she got on welfare. She tried. She tried to sell Avon on the side. She'd collect bottles, you know, because welfare didn't give you much anyway.
Despite Joanne's financial struggles, there's happiness in her life. A bright spot. Well, two, actually. In 1974, Melissa is born. And in 1977, along comes Renee. A single mother to three girls, it's now the four of them against the world.
Joanne was a good mother. She was a good mother. She took care of her kids.
I get a lot of my personality from my mom.
Here's Melissa today.
When I look at her pictures and I think of her, I remember this woman who was so funny and goofy. And she had this bubbly, you know, personality. She loved to dance and do things with family members and hang out and chat and laugh together. I just wish she knew how pretty she was. I wanted to be like her. I wanted to be so pretty like her. My mom had this soft, soft body. It was voluptuous and very feminine, and she had curves from carrying babies. I thought she was beautiful. She had porcelain skin and brown eyes, very expressive, like puppy dog eyes. Beautiful hair that was probably dark brown. She dyed it black. Painted nails, red lipstick that she got from Avon, and stiletto heels. My mom would be in church playing piano with long nails and stiletto heels.
What kinds of things would you and your mom do together?
We did a lot of taking in animals. We had a menagerie. We were always happening upon animals. We loved to walk. We loved to go to the farmer's market. And we loved to go to the park. She made the most average mundane things so exciting. In the winter, when it snowed, she'd make snow cream.
What is snow cream?
Snow cream is snow that you mix with a little bit of vanilla and sugar and milk. And I felt fancy. I said, who else has got snow cream from real snow? Sometimes we, on our walks, we'd pick up cans. Other times, Mama would sell Avon. And if someone gave her an opportunity to earn money and she could physically do it, like an odd job for somebody, she would. Mama did whatever she could, and she swallowed her pride to ask for help from agencies and churches. But it just seemed like no matter what, come the third week of the month, we had hardly anything left, usually just a bag of potatoes and whatever was given to us by a family member.
As real as their money problems are, maybe the bigger issue is the one Joanne had with men. Nat saw it firsthand.
I never liked any of them. They were all creeps. But she didn't see that in people. She didn't judge people. That's just the way she thought everybody had a good heart. And I could be next to somebody and sense that they're a piece of crap right away, you know. But she didn't have that in her. I don't know. She just wasn't built like that.
What do you think was going on with Joanne that she needed to have men around?
I think Joanne was lonely. Joanne felt, because she had the kids and she was overweight, that she didn't have what it took, you know, to keep a guy anymore. And then they would use her and just dump her. It was painful because I seen it, and that's my sister. But there was nothing, you can't help somebody when they're in that kind of state of mind, you know. She just, you know, I just... You know, I love my sister Joanne. She was a good person, but I just somehow she got off on a bad track of trusting people.
No self-confidence. When I met Nat, he didn't have any self-confidence either. Anytime he...
Self-esteem.
Self-esteem, self-confidence.
Yeah. That's just the way we're raised. We weren't raised with a lot of affection or attention or showing anything.
She was raised in an environment where you're taught to marry. Find that man who could take you out of that situation and give you a life where you don't have to struggle so hard. Men were the solution to everything. Even if they weren't the greatest man with the best intentions or personality or integrity or decency, it was a man. And the fact that it was a man, it was very low standards.
And one of those men is Rodney Lincoln. Back in the day, Rodney Lincoln, a white guy with an undeniably great head of brown hair, was 5'5", 122 pounds. Today, Rodney is gray and weighs a touch less.
Forgive me for saying it this way, but you're not the largest man I've ever seen.
5'5", 115 pounds.
You weigh less than I do.
A quick note about Rodney. He's now 77 years old and dealing with some health issues, so sometimes it's a little hard to understand him. Born in South St. Louis on August 19, 1944, Rodney is raised by his mother Mary and stepfather Leonard. The self-proclaimed mischievous prankster enlists in the Navy after high school. It's one of the shorter military careers I've ever heard of.
Well, my naval career lasted about 49 days. I didn't pass the physical once I got to base, and they gave me honorable discharge for medical reasons. So I came home, tried out for St. Louis Cardinals, and made it. I played in the minor league by a year, year and a half.
What position did you play?
Pitcher and shortstop. During that time, I met a young lady that was soon to become Mrs. Lincoln. As we were young, in love, and she said, well, you can't have a family and be away from home all the time. And as a ball player, that's the way life is. So I gave up my dream. We got married.
And eventually, married with children. They end up having four kids, Rodney Patrick, Leonard, Kay, and Kelly. Then, in 1972, life in the Lincoln household changes abruptly.
I got in trouble with the police. I was quite a heavy drinker at the time. I was out drinking, got in an argument, turned into a fight, and mainly ended up dead.
Tell me a little bit more about what happened in 1972.
I gotta say, I was drinking pretty heavy. I was in a bar. I got into an argument with this guy over a pool game.
The guy is Russell Myers.
After we had this little deal with the pool game, he left. Well, I wasn't done drinking, so I stayed at the bar.
Some drinks later, a friend of Rodney's tells him Russell just stole an axe out of his truck. So Rodney goes after him. They fight, then call a truce and decide to go drink. Together. After stocking up on beer and cheap wine, they drive to Jefferson Barracks, an Army and Air National Guard base, cemetery, and park. 337 acres on the banks of the Mississippi River.
So while we're drinking, we get into an argument again.
The argument takes a turn when, according to Rodney, Russell propositions him.
And I said no. And this is when he really started getting angry. Well, he picks up a big rock and throws it at me. I ducked. I picked up a big rock and threw it at him. He didn't. Actually, I panic.
Russell doesn't duck. And the rock Rodney just threw hits him in the head, killing him instantly. Frenzied, Rodney takes off and pulls out right in front of another car.
He had a slam on his brakes to keep from hitting me. He got a pretty good description of my truck. That wasn't long to... Police was coming and questioning me. At first, I denied it. I was scared more than anything. Finally, I told him, look, yeah, I did it. We got an argument. He threw a rock at me. I threw a rock at him. I hit him, and he didn't hit me.
But there's actually more to the story, something that happens before Rodney leaves the scene and is questioned by police. Where was his body, where was Russell Myers' body found?
I dragged his body over to the river, pushed him into the river. They found skull bone tissue, and brain tissue. They dragged Mississippi, but they never did find the body. And eventually I told them, yeah, I did it.
Why did you push his body into the Mississippi River?
Panic. I was scared. I guess in the back of my mind, I thought if I hide the body, nobody would know. Well, from what I heard, the way they found the scene was some guy was walking his dog, and the dog found this stuff, and this guy called the police. So I was convicted of second-degree murder. I was rightfully convicted of second-degree murder.
Rodney is sentenced to 10 years. He's let out in 2.
I was out on parole for 16 months. Got to drinking again. Got getting in trouble again. Wound up getting my parole revoked. Went back to prison. Got out in 1980. I made a vow. I'll never go back to prison again.
I have a question about when you drank, were you a happy drunk? Were you an angry drunk? Did you have a temper?
I was a changeable drunk. Most of the time I was high, happy-go-lucky, and have another drink. But if there was something that made me angry, it was all the way. I could go from having a great time to ready to really hurt somebody.
some months out of prison and vowing to never go back, around mid-1981, 36-year-old Rodney meets 34-year-old Joanne Tate.
It wasn't no big love affair, anything. It was, hey, let's have sex. And that was it.
But again, there's more to it than just that.
Let's go back. Tell me about when and where the circumstances around surrounding you meeting Joanne Tate.
I was working in New Boy.
Rodney's working at Red Villa's Bar at Broadway and Davis in South St. Louis.
It was kind of a neighborhood bar where the old men had nothing to do, go in, sit in there all day and talk about the lives they lived.
Where beers are $1.25 and pool tournaments pack the locals in. And it's during one of these tournaments, Daniel Clenny brings in his sisters, Abby and Joanne.
How did you know Daniel?
At that time, I didn't. I met him there, shooting pool. But I never really knew him. I just met him. And then when he came in, I didn't even recognize him at first. We got talking. Anyway, I got talking to Joanne.
Abby makes it crystal clear she's not interested in Rodney, but Joanne is.
And when they left, she handed me a piece of paper with a name and number on it. Well, when I closed the bar that night, I called the number. She said, yeah, come on over. And that was the first time we'd gotten together.
And where did you go? Where did she live?
She lived in Hyde Park. I think it was Fair Street, Forest Street. I went to her house. Basically, we had sex and I left. I seen Joanne maybe 3-4 times after that. And then we kind of drifted apart. If she didn't call me, I didn't call her.
Fast forward to May 23rd, 1982. Around 1:30 p.m. It's about a month after Joanne's murder, and 7-year-old Melissa just picked out Rodney's photo as the attacker. Here's Melissa again.
I thought I was done. I was so relieved. And then I found out that we had to go down to the police station.
About 3:30 p.m. on the second floor of police headquarters, Melissa and 4-year-old Renee, along with Detective Joe Burgoon and 3 other investigators, enter one side of the lineup room. 4 white males enter the other.
And we're standing on this one side of this glass, and the detective explained to me that I could see them, but they couldn't see me. And he said, I want you to look very carefully at these people. I didn't want to do it. I was worried that the bad guy would get me.
According to the police report, Renee picks none of the men. Melissa picks number 3, Rodney Lincoln.
At the lineup, an officer walked up to me and said, you're in big trouble. And handcuffed me, took me back to the cell.
Rodney agrees to talk with investigators. He tells them about meeting Joanne at the pool tournament, then their brief sexual relationship. And he tells them something else.
One time I went over there, and she was worried about someone bothering her. So being the nice guy I am, I said, well, come over to my house tonight. Her and the 2 girls came over to my house, my mom's house, where I was living. I took the two girls across the street to the park for a while. The two girls slept upstairs in one bed. Joanne and I slept in another bed upstairs. The next morning, took them home, and I think that was the last time I seen them.
Remember, Melissa said she had been to Bill's house. Bill lived with his mom. She said they spent the night upstairs and they played at the park across the street from Bill's.
That evening, they came by and told me that I was being charged with capital murder and two counts of first-degree assault. And my bond was $1 million secured. And I'm making $40 a week. I got $1 million bond. I knew I wasn't making bond.
Rodney is fingerprinted and gives pubic hair and blood samples. Joanne's family soon learns there's been an arrest. Here are Lori and Nat again.
I felt like the police know what they're doing. You know, they're the professionals. They got all the evidence and equipment and technology to find the person. And thank God now they got the guy that did this, because I believed Melissa. If Melissa could remember that much detail at 7 years old about a place she had been a year before, after all the trauma she just went through, I had faith in her. I believe she knew what she was talking about. And I believe Nat felt the same way.
Well, thank God they got him. Thank God they got this guy.
What did you think when you learned Rodney Lincoln had killed a man before?
I thought that, you know, that just reinforces he's a killer. If he killed once, what's going to stop from killing again? That's what I thought, you know.
Back at the station, Rodney agrees to take a polygraph. According to the police report, he's asked these questions. Did you kill Joanne Tate? And did you stick a broom up her rectum?
I soon found out that I didn't pass the polygraph. He says, not good. He said, you lied about everything, including your name. My name? Wait a minute.
5 weeks later, Rodney Lincoln is indicted by the grand jury. And prominently displayed under his name in the indictment is a new detail. Rodney is also known as Bad Bill. Rodney enters his plea of not guilty, and he tells his family the same. Here's Rodney's daughter, Kay, who was 13 at the time.
I mean, the very first time we went to see him, he absolutely, I did not do this. I need you to know, I did not do this. And that's all it took. He only had to tell me once.
In the months that followed, detectives obtained pubic hair samples from 37 people, mostly men. Included in that group are Joanne's family members, Steve Yancey, her neighbor, and Tom Schultz, her ex-boyfriend. But there are two people who refuse to give a hair sample without a court order. Gary LaRose, he's the first person Melissa and Renee's older sister asked about, and Billy Paris, a cousin of Joanne's first husband. But it may not matter, because chief criminalist Harold Messler states in a deposition that a hair found on a blue blanket is microscopically similar to Rodney Lincoln and dissimilar to the victims or any of the other samples collected. Rodney remains in jail for over a year until his trial begins on August 8, 1983. For the prosecution is six-year veteran assistant circuit attorney Joseph Bauer. By the way, prosecutors are called circuit attorneys in St. Louis. For the defense, Robert Hampe. Rodney's older brother cleaned out his retirement fund and took out a second mortgage on his home in order to hire the cocky attorney with a reputation of winning tough cases. The jury, diverse in gender and race, will be sequestered in what's expected to be a less than 2 week trial. Aunt Lori is there day in and day out.
The judge talked to Renee, and he said she was too young to testify, that, you know, they wouldn't allow her. But I do remember sitting in the courtroom, like third or fourth row back, and, you know, seeing some of the testimony. Rodney Lincoln, during the trial, I just remember seeing the back of his head. I do remember I looked over a few times to get a look at the guy, but he just sat there, like, facing the judge the whole time.
How was Melissa on the stand?
Oh, Melissa was very, she was very confident in her testimony.
I remember the trial. It was huge. First of all, the room was so big. And I remember using my manners, and I used my words, and I was loud and spoke out.
And she believed what she was saying. I could tell that, even at 7 years old, and that she, you know, she answered the questions. You know, you almost thought she was like a little adult sitting up there. She was sure that Rodney was the one that did it.
Day 8. Both sides rest, and the jury begins their deliberations. But after 2 days, they're deadlocked, and a hung jury is declared. The split is 7-5, and it's unknown if the majority is for guilt or innocence.
What did you think when it was a hung jury?
Letdown.
It's a big letdown, and what do I want to say? Justice just fell apart. Justice did not do its job. You know, I mean, you know, how could they not, after Melissa's testimony, how could they not convict this guy for Joanne's murder? You know, what these people must not care that are on the jury.
They said they just couldn't believe a kid or something like that.
You know, I don't know, but I was like, this is ridiculous. This is just absolutely ridiculous.
Prosecutors are determined to get their guy and waste no time. Just 2 months after the hung jury, on October 3rd, 1983, the second trial begins.
I was so mad. We did this already. I don't want to talk about this no more. I had started to feel really bad about myself. There were people asking me why I couldn't get help in my family, why I didn't get help. There was a teacher at my school that was fascinated with my case, and she made me come out and tell all the other teachers what happened to me. I was so done talking about it.
Trial number 2. The jury will be sequestered again, but this time it consists of 12 white men. The same attorneys will be trying the case, Robert Hampe for the defense and Joe Bauer for the prosecution. And I'll note that even though Joe Bauer had left the circuit attorney's office for private practice, the state appoints him special assistant circuit attorney for this trial. But there are some differences this go around. There's a different judge. A much bigger deal is made of the hair that is microscopically similar to Rodney's. And there's a surprise witness for the defense, a guy from Joanne's neighborhood, Billy Hayes, who also had been considered a person of interest in the case. He testifies that he had bumped into a man in the Hyde Park neighborhood around the time of the murder. The man, who was wearing bloodstained clothes, threatened to kill him if he ever told anyone of their meeting. Billy Hayes goes on to say that despite meeting with police multiple times, he had not said anything about this until August, more than a year after the murder, because he feared for his life. And he says he has seen the man on at least one other occasion since their first meeting and knows him only as Dave. And for this trial, Melissa, the star witness, is encouraged to be even more dramatic on the witness stand.
I knew I had to get off the stand and point out the bad man. I was scared. And I got down. I remember looking down, I had white patent shoes and a ruffled dress. And I remember walking over and pointing Rodney out.
It was very dramatic and moving. Very emotionally moving. when the prosecuting attorney asked her, you know, can you see the man in the courtroom, can you point out who did it? And she came down off the stand and she pointed at Rodney. She said, he did it. This little girl has the kahunas to stand across a room and point at the guy that she, in her mind, knows murdered her mother and, you know, butchered her and her little sister. You know, that's powerful.
In closing arguments, Special Assistant Circuit Attorney Joe Bauer reminds jurors of some of the most gruesome details, saying in part, quote,
Joanne Tate was dead with a broom inserted into her body some 28 inches. We know that Joanne Tate walked around after she was stabbed because her feet, on the bottom of them, had blood, her blood. And I submit to you that in order to insert that broom, he had to wait until she was on the floor before he attempted to do that.
Bauer goes on to say, quote,
the knife that was used on that little girl's vagina was a blunt knife, not a sharp knife. If you look at State's Exhibit 16, this is a blunt knife. All the other knives are pretty sharp steak knives. This is what was used on that little girl's vagina.
And about Melissa's ability to ID her attacker, he says, quote,
when he has her on the bed with her little legs around his hips and he's trying to kiss her, do you think she could forget that face? Do you think she could ever forget that face?
Now it's the defense's turn, and Robert Hampe starts by calling out all the inconsistencies in Melissa's testimony.
Now that little girl told everybody in life that she talked to that a man named Bill did it. The littlest one said Bill did it. Immediately after it happened, she told them they did it. Now we've got Bill, who isn't Bill. Gary, who isn't Gary. But it sure as hell isn't Rodney. The most distinctive feature about Rodney Lincoln, and he's a little kind of blend into the woodwork kind of guy. The most distinctive feature about him is the fact that he has a finger missing. All of you have been around children. You know how they think. You know how they act. You know that that child would have remembered that had she known that Rodney Lincoln was the man that did this.
He concludes by saying that no matter how sympathetic Renee and the now 8-year-old Melissa are, the jurors should not let that affect them while trying to reach a verdict. He says, quote,
those kids have been down the road, and your heart has to go out to the 8-year-old. But if you heard what she said from an adult, you would not listen to it for 10 minutes, not for 10 seconds. And you cannot accept such testimony from a child, considering how important this is.
Bauer's rebuttal? He offers up an explanation for Melissa's changing story, saying, because of all the constant police questioning and the horrible extent of her wounds, quote,
she just gave them a name, Bill, to shut everybody up. And she didn't pick Lincoln from a bunch of photographs because she knew him. She saw several pictures of people her mother knew, and she said she knew them, but they did not kill her mother.
On October 7th, the fifth day of the trial, jury deliberations begin. They start at 10:55 a.m. And that same day, at 5:28 p.m., they come back with a verdict. Guilty. Of two counts of first-degree assault with a deadly weapon and guilty of the lesser charge of manslaughter, not capital murder like the prosecution had argued for. A complete shock to everyone there.
So, when you hear the guilty verdict?
Dumbfounded. Stunned.
Who was in the courtroom for you the day of the guilty verdict? Was your mom there?
My mom, my brother.
Do you remember looking at them?
On the way out, I remember Mom sitting there, her head up high, shoulders back, and she mouthed the words, I love you. That was a hard day.
Here's Rodney's daughter, Kay.
I remember my mom telling me that he wouldn't be coming home. He had been convicted. And, well, what do you mean? Well, they said he was guilty. He's not coming home. And, you know, something in me broke that day.
Rodney is sentenced to 2 life terms for the attack on the girls and 15 years for Joanne's murder, all to run consecutively.
I was thinking he deserved a death penalty because to me that crime would deserve that, a death penalty from what I saw and from what happened. I just felt relieved that they got this guy and now we can go on with our life, you know, minus a sister and 2 damaged nieces, you know.
So that was it. The end of a horrible nightmare for Joanne's family and her girls. Justice is finally served. Lock him up and throw away the key, right? The road to healing can finally start? Not even close. The pain is just beginning.
I was told a bad man was in prison, and I never have to think of him or talk about him again. My family reminded me quite often that everything was done, I was safe, and nothing to worry about, but yet I always felt like I was being watched. I never felt safe or secure, and I had nightmares all the time. Because to me, there was no reason to feel safe and secure.
Next time on The Real Killer.
I wrote all his charges all over the exterior of this envelope. I wrote baby rapist, I wrote woman killer, I wrote predator.
Melissa's on a mission to make Rodney's life a living hell.
Did you want harm to come to him?
I wasn't opposed to it.
And Rodney's daughter is equally as driven to save him.
I knew nothing about investigating. I knew nothing about researching. I was just dumbfounded by the things I had found. This isn't over. I'm not done.
The Real Killer is a production of AYR Media and iHeartRadio, hosted by me, Leah Rothman. Executive producers Leah Rothman and Aliza Rosen for AYR Media. Written by me, Leah Rothman. Senior Associate Producer Eric Newman. Editing and sound design by Cameron Taggy. Mixed and mastered by Cameron Taggy. Audio engineering by Jesus C. Murillo. Studio engineering by Tom Weir and Kelly McGrew. Voice acting performed by Clayton Ferris and Alex Salem. Legal counsel for AYR Media, Gianni Douglas. Executive producer for iHeartRadio, Chandler Mays. If you're enjoying The Real Killer, tell your friends about it and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.